Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Salmon of Doubt by Douglas Adams. Narrated by Simon Jones, with the voices of Stephen Fry, Richard Dawkins, and Christopher Cerf. This work is copyrighted 2002 by Completely Unexpected Productions Limited. This recording is copyrighted 2003 by Recorded Books. Douglas Adams was born in Cambridge, England in 1952. And was later educated there at St. John's College. The author of the 5 books in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy, yes, you heard correctly, trilogy, and 2 Dirk Gently novels, Adams first worked as a radio producer and writer for the BBC, where he adapted his madcap interstellar odyssey for broadcast in 1979 to instant acclaim and recognition. A lifelong technophile, in more recent years, Adams turned to writing computer games, such as Starship Titanic, and was a highly respected commentator on the development of the Internet and the multimedia. On Friday, May 11, 2001, Douglas Adams died at the age of 49 of a heart attack. The following are a collection of essays, unfinished writings, and hilarious titbits culled by his friends from his beloved collection of computers. And now, The Salmon of Doubt.
So every morning the three of us would set out. Me, the large English writer, Trudy the poodle, and Maggie, the mert. I would run jog stroll along the wide dirt track that ran through the dry red dunes. Trudy would gamble friskily along, this way and that, ears flapping, and Maggie would bowl along cheerily biting her neck. Trudy was extraordinarily good-natured and long-suffering about this, but every now and then she would suddenly get monumentally fed up. At that moment she would execute a sudden mid-air about-turn, land squarely on her feet facing Maggie, and give her an extremely pointed look, whereupon Maggie would suddenly sit and start gently gnawing her own right rear foot, as if she was bored with Trudy anyway. Then they'd start up again and go running and rolling and tumbling, chasing and biting, out through the dunes, through the scrubby grass and undergrowth, and then every now and then would suddenly and inexplicably come to a halt, as if they had both, simultaneously, run out of moves. They would then stare into the middle distance in embarrassment for a bit, before starting up again. So what part did I play in all this? Well, none, really. They completely ignored me for the whole 20 or 30 minutes, which was perfectly fine, of course, I didn't mind. But it did puzzle me, because early every morning they would come yelping and scratching around the doors and windows of my house until I got up and took them for their walk. If anything disturbed the daily ritual, like I had to drive into town, or have a meeting, or fly to England or something, they would get thoroughly miserable and simply not know what to do. Despite the fact that they would always completely ignore me whenever we went on our walks together, they couldn't just go and have a walk without me. This revealed a profoundly philosophical bent in these dogs which were not mine, because they had worked out that I had to be there in order for them to be able to ignore me properly. You can't ignore someone who isn't there, because that's not what ignore means. Further depths to their thinking were revealed when Michael's girlfriend Victoria told me that once, when coming to visit me, she had tried to throw a ball for Maggie and Trudy to chase. The dogs had sat and watched, stony-faced, as the ball climbed up into the sky, dropped, and at last dribbled along the ground to a halt. She said that the message she was picking up from them was, "We don't do that. We hang out with writers." Which was true. They hung out with me all day, every day. But exactly like writers, dogs who hang out with writers don't like the actual writing bit. So they would moon around at my feet all day and keep nudging my elbow out of the way while I was typing, so that they could rest their chins on my lap and gaze mournfully up at me in the hope that I would see reason and go for a walk so that they could ignore me properly. And then in the evening they would trot off to their real home to be fed, watered, and put to bed for the night, which seemed to me like a fine arrangement, because I got all the pleasure of their company, which was considerable, without having any responsibility for them. And it continued to be a fine arrangement up until the day when Maggie turned up bright and early in the morning, ready and eager to ignore me on her own. No Trudy. Trudy was not with her. I was stunned. I didn't know what had happened to Trudy, and had no way of finding out, because she wasn't mine. Had she been run over by a truck? Was she lying somewhere, bleeding by the roadside? Maggie seemed restless and worried. She would know where Trudy was, I thought, and what had happened to her. I'd better follow her like Lassie. I put on my walking shoes and hurried out. We walked for miles, roaming around the desert looking for Trudy, following the most circuitous route. Eventually, I realized that Maggie wasn't looking for Trudy at all. She was just ignoring me. A strategy which I was complicating by trying to, I can't be bothered to explain, led me to borrow somebody's house way out in the desert just north of Santa Fe to write a screenplay in. To give you an idea of the sort of place that Santa Fe is, I could bang on about the desert and the altitude and the light and the silver and turquoise jewellery, but the best thing is just to mention a traffic sign on the freeway from Albuquerque. It says, in large letters, Gusty Winds, and in smaller letters, May Exist. I never met my neighbours. They lived half a mile away on top of the next sand ridge, but as soon as I started going out for my morning run, jog, gentle stroll, I met their dogs, who were so instantly and deliriously pleased to see me that I wondered if they thought we'd met in a previous life. Shirley MacLaine lived nearby, and they might have picked up all kinds of weird ideas from just being near her. Their names were Maggie and Trudy. Trudy was an exceptionally silly-looking dog, a large black French poodle who moved exactly as if she had been animated by Walt Disney, a kind of lollop, which was emphasized by her large floppy ears at the front end and a short stubby tail with a bit of topiary work on the end. Her coat consisted of a matting of tight black curls, which added to the general Disney effect by making it seem that she was completely devoid of naughty bits. The way in which she signified every morning that she was deliriously pleased to see me was to do a thing which I always thought was called prinking, but is in fact called stotting. I've only just discovered my error. My nose. My mother has a long nose, and my father had a wide one, and I got both of them combined. It's large. The only person I ever knew with a nose substantially larger than mine was a master at my prep school, who also had tiny little eyes, hardly any chin, and was ludicrously thin. He resembled a cross between a flamingo and an old-fashioned farming implement, and walked rather unsteadily in crosswinds. He also hid a great deal. I wanted to hide, too. As a boy, I was teased unmercifully about my nose for years, until one day I happened to catch sight of my profile in a pair of angled mirrors and had to admit that it was actually pretty funny. From that moment, people stopped teasing me about my nose and instead started to tease me unmercifully about the fact that I said words like actually, which is something that has never let up to this day. One of the more curious features of my nose is that it doesn't admit any air. This is hard to understand or even believe. The problem goes back a very long way to when I was a small boy living in my grandmother's house. My grandmother was the local representative of the RSPCA, which meant the house was always full of badly damaged dogs and cats, and even the occasional badger, stoat, or pigeon. Some of them were damaged physically, some psychologically, but the effect they had on me was to seriously damage my attention span. Because the air was thick with animal hair and dust, my nose was continually inflamed and runny, and every extraordinary achievement had the same effect on me that those geological upheavals had on whole civilizations in Rider Haggard novels. It effectively sealed me off from the outside world forever. Various ENT specialists have at different times embarked on major speleological expeditions into my nasal passages, but most of them have come back baffled. The ones that didn't come back baffled didn't come back at all, and are therefore now part of the problem rather than part of the solution. The only thing that ever tempted me to try taking cocaine was the dire warning that the stuff eats away at your septum. If I thought cocaine could actually find a way through my septum, I would happily shove it up there by the bucketful and let it eat away as much as it liked. I have been put off, however, by the observation that we should have that in the alphabet as well. There's room for it. Why doesn't have to be the last word. It isn't even the last letter. How would it be if the alphabet ended not VWXYZ, but VWX, why not? Don't ask stupid questions. From Hockney's Alphabet. The meaning of LIF started life as an English exercise I had to do at school, which then got turned into a game 15 years later by John Lloyd and myself. We were sitting with a few friends in a Greek taverna, playing charades, and drinking Retsina all afternoon until we needed to find a game that didn't require so much standing up. It realized that everybody is as stupid as you are, and that all we are doing when we are standing in the kitchen, wondering what we came in here for, is woking. Gradually, little stacks of index cards with these words on started to grow in John Lloyd's bottom drawer, and anybody who heard about them would add concepts of their own. They first saw the light of day when John Lloyd was putting together the Not 1982 calendar and was stuck for things to go on the bottoms of the pages, and also the tops and quite a few middles. He turned out the drawer, chose a dozen or so of the best new words, and inserted them in the book under the name Oxtail English Dictionary. This quickly turned out to be one of the most popular bits of Not 1982, and the success of the idea on this small scale suggested the possibility of a book devoted to it. And here it is. The Meaning of Lif. The product of a hard lifetime's work, studying and chronicling the behaviour of man. From the introduction, The Meaning of Lif. Caught, bandaged, and slippered. I didn't care. It was the Beatles. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, shorts. We had to wear them. Even though we all had to wear them, it did begin to get a bit ridiculous in my case. It wasn't so much towering over the other boys I minded so much, it was towering over the masters, wearing shorts. My mother pleaded with the principal on one occasion to please make an exception in my case and let me wear long trousers, but Jack Higgs, ever fair but first, would take 6 weeks. 6 weeks! 6 minus 2 was, as we had been so carefully and painstakingly taught, 4. Which meant that for 4 whole weeks of the next term, I was going to be the only boy in school wearing shorts. For the next 2 weeks, I took up playing in the traffic, being careless with kitchen knives and neglecting to stand clear of the doors on station platforms. But, sadly, I led a charmed life, and I had to go through with it. 4 weeks of the greatest humiliation and embarrassment known to man, or rather to that most easily humiliated and embarrassed of all creatures, the overgrown 12-year-old boy. We've all experienced those painful dreams in which we suddenly discover we are stark naked in the middle of the high street. Believe me, this was worse, and it wasn't a dream. The story rather fizzles out there, because a month later, of course, I got my long trousers and was readmitted into polite society. But believe me, I still carry the scars inside, and though I try my best to bestride the world like a colossus, writing best-selling books and... well, that's about it, really, I suppose... if I ever come across as a maladjusted, socially isolated, sad, hunched, emotional cripple, I'm thinking mainly of Sunday mornings in February here, then it's those 4 weeks of having to wear short trousers in September 1964 that are to blame. Saw my own leg off in order to go. I went. In front of 200 people in a pub, Paul McCartney stood up and played songs he'd never, I think, played in public before. Here, there and everywhere... and Blackbird, to name but two. I've played Blackbird in pubs, for heaven's sake. I spent weeks learning the guitar part when I was supposed to be revising for A-levels. I almost wondered if I was hallucinating. There were, though, 2 moments of complete astonishment. One was the last encore, which was an immaculate, thunderous performance of, believe it or not, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Remember, this was in a pub. And the other was one of the world's greatest rock and roll songs, Can't Buy Me Love, which I had first heard crouching with my ear cupped to the dance set record player in the school matron's room. There is a game people like to play which goes, when would you most like to have lived and why? The Italian Renaissance? Mozart's Vienna? Shakespeare's England? Personally, I would like to have been around Bach, but I have a real difficulty with the game, which is that living at any other period of history would have meant missing the Beatles, and I honestly don't think I could do that. Mozart and Bach and Shakespeare are always with us, but I grew up with the Beatles, and I'm not sure what else has affected me as much as that. So Paul McCartney is 50 tomorrow. Happy birthday, Paul. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. One else could hear it. Impossible harmonies and part playing you had never heard in pop songs before. The Beatles were obviously just putting all this stuff in some secret fun of their own, and it seemed exciting to me that people could have fun in that way. The next exciting thing was that they kept on losing me. They would bring out a new album, and for a few listenings it would leave me cold and confused. Then gradually it would begin to unravel itself in my mind. I would realize that the reason I was confused was that I was listening to something that was simply unlike anything that anybody had done before. Another Girl, Good Day Sunshine, and the extraordinary Drive My Car. These tracks are so familiar now that it takes us...
impish, an unrivaled sense of irony, and a peculiar knack for making absurd yet logical connections, and you get such one-of-a-kind creations as the line of electromechanical security robots who repeatedly shout, "Resistance is useless," even as they're destroyed by their attackers. Or the guidebook publisher who, after carefully reviewing every aspect of life on Earth, decides that all the useful information a space traveler could ever want about the human race can be summed up in the phrase, "mostly harmless." Or, to choose an example from the tantalizing fragment of Douglas's unfinished and oft-postponed next novel that appears in this volume, the cab driver who, having noted that no one has ever jumped into his taxi and I'm grateful you left that hard disk behind, so we can all share this one last conversation with you. Christopher Cerf, New York, February 2002.
I would fire off an email to Douglas. He would reply, often within minutes, whether in London or Santa Barbara or some hotel room anywhere in the world. Unlike most staffers of professional helplines, Douglas understood exactly my problem, knew exactly why it was troubling me, and always had the solution ready, lucidly and amusingly explained. Our frequent email exchanges brimmed with literary and scientific jokes and affectionately sardonic little asides. His technophilia shone through, but so did his rich sense of the absurd. The whole world was one big Monty Python sketch, and the follies of humanity are as comic in the world's Silicon Valleys as anywhere else. He laughed at himself with equal good humour, at, for example, his epic bouts of writer's block. I love deadlines. I love the whooshing noise they make as they go by. When, according to legend, his publisher and book agent would literally lock him in a hotel room with no telephone and nothing to do but write, releasing him only for supervised walks. If his enthusiasm ran away with him, and step of the argument. At the end, he pronounced himself satisfied. He really did now understand how televisions work. But I expect there are just a few little men in there, aren't there? Science has lost a friend. Literature has lost a luminary. The mountain gorilla and the black rhino have lost a gallant defender. He once climbed Kilimanjaro in a rhino suit to raise money to fight the cretinous trade in rhino horn. Apple Computer has lost its most eloquent apologist. And I have lost an irreplaceable intellectual companion and one of the kindest and funniest men I ever met. I officially received a happy piece of news yesterday, which would have delighted him. I wasn't allowed to tell anyone during the weeks I've secretly known about it, and now that I am allowed to, it is too late. The sun is shining, life must go on, seize the day, and all those clichés. We shall plant a tree this very day, a Douglas fir, tall, upright, evergreen. It is the wrong time of year, but we'll give it our best shot. Off to the Arboretum. Interesting hole I find myself in. Fits me rather neatly, doesn't it? In fact, it fits me staggeringly well. Must have been made to have me in it. This is such a powerful idea that as the sun rises in the sky and the air heats up, and as, gradually, the puddle gets smaller and smaller, it's still frantically hanging on to the notion that everything's going to be all right, because this world was meant to have him in it, was built to have him in it. So the moment he disappears, catches him rather by surprise. I think this may be something we need to be on the watch out for. Douglas introduced me to Lala. They had worked together years ago on Doctor Who, and it was she who pointed out to me that he had a wonderful childlike capacity to go straight for the wood and never mind the trees. If you try and take a cat apart to see how it works, the first thing you have on your hands is a non-working cat. Life is a level of complexity that almost lies outside our vision. It is so far beyond anything we have any means of understanding that we just think of it as a different class of object, a different class of matter. Life, something that had a mysterious essence about it, was God-given, and that's the only explanation we had. The bombshell comes in 1859, when Darwin publishes On the Origin of Species. It takes a long time before we really get to grips with this and begin to understand it, because not only does it seem incredible and thoroughly demeaning to us, but it's yet another shock to our system to discover that not only are we not the centre of the universe, and we're not made of anything, but we started out as some kind of slime and got to where we are via being a monkey. It just doesn't read well. I am happy to say that Douglas's acquaintance with a particular modern book on evolution, which he chanced upon in his early 30s, seems to have been something of a Damascus experience for him. It all fell into place. It was a concept of such stunning simplicity, but it gave rise, naturally, to all of the infinite and baffling...
In that sense, and I don't think I'm being disrespectful here, Douglas could, mano a mano, tete a tete, talk one into the ground. Affably wearing, but exhausting all the same. But he could no more write boringly than he could execute a perfect pirouette. And, believe me, there have been few human beings born less able to execute pirouettes without the destruction of furniture and all hope of safety to innocent bystanders than Douglas Noel Adams. He was a writer. There are those who write from time to time and do it well, and there are writers. Douglas, and it is pointless to attempt here an explanation or anatomization, was born, grew up, and remained a writer to his too early dying day. For the last random, for the purposes of argument, you are aware that what they do for the world, and the results are, of course, magnificent. But when you look at Blake, listen to Bach, read Douglas Adams, or watch Eddie Izzard perform, you feel you are perhaps the only person in the world who really gets them. Just about everybody else admires them, of course, but no one really connects with them in the way you do. I advance this as a theory. Douglas's work is not the high art of Bach or the intense personal cosmos of Blake, it goes without saying, but I believe my view holds nonetheless. It's like falling in love. When an especially peachy Adams turn of phrase or epithet enters the eye and penetrates the brain, you want to tap the shoulder of the nearest stranger and share it. The stranger might laugh and seem to enjoy the writing, but you hug to yourself the thought that they didn't quite understand its force and quality the way you do, just as your friends, thank heavens, don't also fall in love with the person you are going on and on about to them. You are on the verge of entering the wise, provoking, benevolent, hilarious, and addictive world of Douglas Adams. Don't bolt it all whole. As with Douglas's beloved Japanese food, what seems light and easy to assimilate is subtler and more nutritious by far than might at first appear. The bottom drawer of recently deceased writers is often best left firmly locked.
What traffic? I asked. The traffic that would be there, said the law, if there was any traffic. This was a bit metaphysical, even for me, so I explained, a bit lamely, that in England we just park wherever we can find a parking space available, and weren't that fussy about which side of the street it was on. He looked at me aghast, as if I was lucky to have got out of a country of such wild and crazy car parkers alive, and promptly gave me a ticket. Clearly he would rather have deported me before my subversive ideas brought chaos and anarchy to streets which normally had to cope with nothing more alarming than a few simple assault rifles, which, as we know, in the States are perfectly legal, and without which they would be overrun by herds of deer, overbearing government officers, and lawless British tea importers. My late friend Graham Chapman, an idiosyncratic driver at the best of times, used to exploit the mutual incomprehension of British and U.S. driving habits by always carrying both British and Californian driver's licenses. Whenever he was stopped in the U.S., he would flash his British license, and vice versa. He would also mention that he was just on his way to the airport to leave the country, which he always found to be such welcome news that the police would breathe a sigh of relief and wave him on. But though there are frequent misunderstandings between the Europeans and the Americans, at least we've had decades of shared movies and TV to help us get used to each other. Outside those bounds, you can't make any assumptions at all. In China, for instance, the poet James Fenton was once stopped for having a light on his bicycle. "How would it be?" the police officer asked him severely. If everybody did that. However, the most extreme example I've come across of something being absolutely forbidden in one country and normal practice in another is one I can't quite bring myself to believe, though my cousin swears it's true. She lived for several years in Tokyo and tells of a court case in which a driver who was being prosecuted for driving up onto the pavement, crashing into a shop window and killing a couple of pedestrians, was allowed to enter the fact that he was blind drunk at the time as a plea in mitigation. What are the rules you need to know if you are moving from one country to another? What are the things that are compulsory in one country and forbidden in another? Common sense won't tell you. We have to tell each other.